it first did not know that the movie was necessarily going to be that much of a travel movie, because we thought it, Rick thought it would be filmed in Texas, because his two films at that point had been filmed in Texas. He thought maybe this film would be made in San Antonio, which is not the most romantic place in the world.
Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today I talk with screenwriter Kim Krizan, who co-wrote the classic 1995 travel movie Before Sunrise. Before Sunrise follows a young American guy named Jesse, played by Ethan Hawke, and a young French woman named Celine, played by Julie Delpy, as they meet on a train traveling through Austria, begin a conversation, and wind up getting off the train together in Vienna, where they spend the night walking and talking and ultimately falling in love.
Now I'm going to call my best friend in Paris, who I'm supposed to have lunch with in 8 hours. Okay?
Okay.
Ring, ring. Pick up the phone.
Hello?
I don't think I'm going to be able to make it for lunch today. I'm sorry. I met a guy on the train and I got off with him in Vienna. We're still there.
Are you crazy?
Probably.
Kim and I are joined in this conversation by my wife, Kiki, with whom I have my own story of walking and talking and falling in love. Kiki is here to help me introduce this episode, since our conversation with Kim was more about travel than the film itself, and we wanted to talk some more about the movie and its characters, since we both love it so much. But before we dig into the movie itself, I did want to bring up one thing. Kiki, what happened like 2 minutes into our conversation with Kim?
I think I mentioned that you teach a class in Paris every summer, and that derailed the entire conversation in a good way.
Oh, fantastic. What are you teaching in Paris?
I teach creative writing.
Wow.
I teach a travel memoir class specifically. And, okay. And this is neither here nor there, but if you ever want to co-teach a sort of screenwriting creativity place as muse class, let me know.
I love it. Are you kidding?
And I said something along the lines of, well, why don't you do a class with us too? Since you wrote one of the iconic Paris movies, Before Sunset, which actually this is an episode about Before Sunrise, but the sequel is set in Paris. And so we created the very first Kim Krizan Before Sunset screenwriting class in Paris. It'll be August 25th through 29th this summer, 2025. If you're interested in being a student in that class, just message me at deviate@rolfpotts.com or go to pariswritingworkshops.com for more information about it. This is the first time we're going to do it, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
I'm going to be auditing it too. I think I'll be thrilled that I'll be able to take this from Kim and really learn some lessons about my own interest in screenwriting in the City of Light. I think it should be a ball.
But let's talk a little bit. Let's tease Kim's interview. We talked with Kim and we ended up talking a lot about travel more than the movie itself.
I think she was excited to talk about travel. She probably doesn't get to be interviewed about that very much.
And she talked about a trip that she took with her family to Eastern Europe, to the Czech Republic when she was a kid, which was clearly influential on her, and I feel like maybe the fact that Julie Delpy's character is from Eastern Europe, has a grandmother in Hungary, is a part of something that came out of Kim's brain pan. But then she also talks about taking Brit Rail, which is something you can relate to.
Well, I think we're both Anglophiles, and she really fell in love and found her own independence in terms of traveling on her own when she was younger, when she went to England, and I certainly related to that for sure.
And she did meet a guy. She didn't meet him on a train. She met him at a conference. You'll hear about that later when we talk to Kim. But it's funny how when the movie is so specific and you think, oh, well, Kim must have had this experience with a guy on a train. Well, she met a guy at a concert, not in Vienna, but in England. And they had this experience, which sort of inspired her art. And so I think that's interesting to hear about, that art doesn't necessarily need to be a one-to-one.
Mm-mm.
And it's funny, to me, this is like the quintessential Eurail movie.
Mm.
But Rick had never been on the Eurail. I mean, this is based on an experience that he had in Philadelphia. He was in his late 20s. He met a German girl in her early 20s, and they walked around and talked all night, and they just enjoyed that connection. Mm-hmm. And so when he approached Kim, who we'll talk to in a second, when he approached Kim to co-write this movie, he didn't think it was a travel movie. He just wanted a movie about connection and conversation and the idea that you can grow closer through ideas. And he wanted to celebrate this really strong connection he felt with the German girl. And actually, when he made the movie, I think he sort of hoped he would find her again. Mm. And the sad thing is that eventually one of her friends emailed and said she died in a motorcycle crash.
No. Yeah. Oh, no. I just got chills. That's awful.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And so you think of Before Sunset, which Jesse, the sequel to Before Sunrise, Jesse, he writes that book hoping maybe he can find her again. Mm-hmm. So Rick Linklater maybe was sort of trying to find this woman named Amy, this German woman. And
I just want to stop you right here. Did you get permission from Richard Linklater to call him Rick?
No, but Kim calls him Rick.
Okay. So you feel by extension so that you're allowed.
I'm called out by my wife for false familiarity with one of the great filmmakers of my generation. Well, let's talk about our personal reactions to the movie. And again, this is a travel movie about two strangers who meet on a train and get off and spend the night walking and talking together.
She's French. He's American. I don't remember the first time I watched it, but I bet it was in college on VHS.
I saw it at a Dollar Cinema in Wichita, at the Palace Cinema.
And is that near the airport?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I remember being really annoyed because there was a couple of teenagers sitting behind me and they were just talking the whole time. It's not a very plot-driven movie. It's a conversation-driven movie. And the teenagers were just, they weren't into it.
But weren't you a teenager?
No, I'm 10 years older than you.
Oh, right.
I'm 9 years older than you.
So you were?
So I was 24 when I saw it. But the funny thing is that it made me long for a couple of things. One is for the connection that is portrayed by these two characters over the course of a night, but also for travel. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a passport when I was 24 years old. It sort of seeded the idea that travel was full of possibility, which is fun.
Yeah, it hit on so many romantic levels, not only, and I mean, you talk about how Rick, no, I'll call him Richard because I have more respect.
Sorry, Richard.
Had this connection with a German girl, but they transposed it to Vienna, which just sounds romantic and otherworldly. And also they were on a train and a dining car and all of this sort of stuff to lay it out. And train travel just inherently is more romantic than an EasyJet plane trip, which I took, or a bus. I think one of the beautiful things, the kind of delicious, achy parts of rewatching it just a couple weeks ago before we interviewed Kim was that it reminded me of what we had, but it also...
With our connection.
No, just of anyone's connection. It reminded me of what we had collectively. The ability to meet, to meet a stranger on a train or to have this gorgeous chance encounter that you'll never see this person again, and yet it sticks with you somehow because of the effervescence and the evanescence more appropriately.
I'm curious, did you ever have like an experience with someone, romantic or otherwise, that you just let lie and you didn't try to sully by keeping in touch?
Sure. I mean, I remember there was an encounter with someone in Italy in a tiny town that wasn't even that touristy, but I was there and I was coupled, so it was a chaste encounter, but there was definitely this moment where like we said goodbye. He stroked my eyebrow with his thumb. He didn't kiss me. I was dating someone that I was very much in love with at the time, but the hot Italian summer night, and there was this kind of lovely little moment where we both acknowledged that we saw something in each other, and I don't know where he is. We didn't keep in touch, but he stroked my eyebrow with his thumb. It was so romantic. Please don't do that. That'd be too weird. You try to like replicate that moment.
Well, now you all heard it here that I'm not allowed to stroke my wife's eyebrow
with your thumb
because she's been ruined for the experience by an Italian man.
Well, it was just one of those chance encounters that was perfect in that moment. If we had tried to extend it, or if it had, you know, I think we both knew that it was best kept on that little piazza at 2 a.m. in Italy.
That's worth honoring, and I wish you one had the sense to know when to just let it go and when to circle back. Yours was obvious. You were in love with somebody else, and so you allowed this simple moment of intimacy just remain perfect. At the exact same time that Jesse and Celine were traveling in 1994, I was vagabonding around the United States and I met a girl in Florida that I was really into, but I ruined it by keeping in touch.
Right.
You know, in a sense, it would have been perfect had it just been Florida, because it was such a cool experience. And I've said before, if I had a smartphone, I wouldn't have met her. She was sitting outside of a hostel and we started talking and we walked around. There was nothing to distract us, but then I kept in touch and then I made some phone calls, but it was expensive to call, so I probably didn't call as much as I should. And she had a life to live, you know, and I ruined my memory of that experience by trying to extend it. And so I think that's maybe what Jesse and Celine were trying to do. I asked you earlier about your favorite scene from the movie. I remember watching this movie when I was young. I think I was watching it like for the second or third time, probably on VHS. And I wrote down, it's that great scene where Celine is talking to Jesse in an alley. And she's talking about how if there's any sort of God, she doesn't think it exists in us, but in this space between us.
You know, I believe if there's any kind of God, it wouldn't be in any of us. Not you or me, but just this little space in between. If there's any kind of magic in this world, it must be in the attempt of understanding someone, sharing something. I know, it's almost impossible to succeed, but who cares, really? The answer must be in the attempt.
I love that so much, and I wrote it down. But then you, when we watched it together, you gave me a hard time because it's like, oh, of course you wrote that down. You're the
right.
That feels written.
It did feel written. And I mean, in watching it again, truly, I wouldn't have wanted to change anything about this film. I don't know that there's anything that's perfect in art, but this is a perfect film. It's complete. As an actor, there's a monologue that I actually was toying with the other day from a play that I'd performed in called People, Places, and Things. But she talks about how, as an actor, you're lucky enough to get to speak poetry, words that you would never think of to say, but which become yours as soon as you say them. So Julie Delpy was making this beautiful poetic sentiment her own, but I could still see it on the page, and that's fine. That sounded like Kim and Richard writing it, maybe more than Celine. It just felt like a very advanced sentiment for someone in her 20s. But maybe I'm thinking of my own self in my early 20s, and there's no way I would have come up with that.
Any further thoughts before we transition into our conversation with Kim?
Yes. I would like to mention that in preparation for this interview with her, we had talked about watching the movie together collectively because we hadn't seen it together, right?
Yeah, I've seen it a ton of times, but I never watched it with you.
I've seen it many times as well, but it had been quite a while and we were going to watch it together. So we did. We watched it in bed, which we don't often watch movies in bed.
It was my request because I was so tired.
Right. Anyway, so we start to watch it, and about 20 minutes through, I realize there's no way I'm not going to be able to finish the end of this movie because it's just so beautiful. You get sucked into it and it's just, you fall in love with this whole thing. And I look over and you're out, your mouth is open and you're like breathing through your mouth. And it's about this movie where he's constantly, well, they're both talking about like, oh, marriage, it's the worst. You're going to get so annoyed with your partner down the line, and the things that you fall in love with will be supplanted by all these things that annoy you. And I had this moment of like, here I am watching this young idealistic love with my partner who's like, you know, breathing through his mouth asleep next to me. And instead of being like kind of eye rolling, I truly was like, there's something beautiful about this moment too. Like, I loved you in that moment in a way that, okay, maybe wasn't Jesse and Celine, but it was also, there was something really soft and gentle and slightly funny about the fact that, you know, 40-year-old, 50-year-old us confronting these 20-year-old versions of ourselves, and we're not them anymore.
Well, on that tone, let's transition to Kim's interview. You actually outed me to Kim.
I did.
Falling asleep.
I did. And you were a good sport about it, but, you know, that's what happens. That's what you get when you don't stay up for the whole movie.
Ladies and gentlemen, our interview with Kim Krizan.
the movie Before Sunrise is sort of seen as a classic romantic movie, but it's also a classic travel movie. And since travel is my thing, I think that's where I want to start. Like how travel influences the way you have experiences and the way you tell stories. So just tell me, Kim, what role did travel play in your life when you were a young person before this was ever an idea for a movie?
Tremendous role in my life, actually, a huge role. And I'll tell you, the trip that really changed me was a trip I took with my father and grandmother to a communist country. My father was 100% Czech from South Dakota. And so, there are Czech communities up there. And so he asked his family and his mother about his roots, and gradually through doing a lot of research, discovered that we still had family back in the old country. My father started contacting these people. He had to have his mother translate because he had been raised speaking Czech, but had forgotten it. His mother had to translate, and he connected with all these people, and he planned to go with his mother and stepfather. At the very, very last minute, his stepfather got sick, and I got taken out of high school to go with my father and grandmother. So I got quite the education at age 16.
Wow.
Hmm. So my mind was absolutely blown at an early age by travel.
And what did you internalize? I mean, obviously you went back probably more than once to Europe. So, but what seed was planted that made you a traveler?
That travel is the best education.
Yep.
That it is really, I mean, reading books is the great thing in school, but to actually go to another country and to meet the people on the street, to look into their eyes, to see the way they behave, to see the way the country is organized, you get the feel for it immediately. I mean, just simple things like getting on a bus or walking down the streets, you get a feel. So I realized I have to travel the world to really understand, and I will never understand unless I go there. And the other thing is you're so awake and aware. Everything's firing in your mind because you're in a strange and foreign environment. You can't go on autopilot. Mm-mm. You have to be awake and aware. And so travel for me is the best education ever.
Did those early trips inform what later became Before Sunrise? I know that the Celine character has a grandmother in Eastern Europe. Or was it further travels that really were the grist for what eventually became Before Sunrise?
The next trip, a major trip I took was to England. I was about 21 and I could travel cheaply all over the island. I could go the length of the entire island, the width of the, and I bought myself a Let's Go. Do you remember Let's
Go? Yes.
Yeah.
Because we didn't have, we didn't have a cell phone back then, right? No. So we had Let's Go. And I went everywhere all by myself. And that was a very romantic thing. I had a backpack. I only had a few items of clothing. I had some novels, and I traveled and met people and met, I would meet, say, a female, and then we'd be pals for a couple days and run around and stay in the same youth hostel and go sightseeing. And then we'd split off, and then I might meet a guy on the train, and we might get off the train and, sightsee in a beautiful town together for a bit. So it wasn't a perfect, facsimile of what happened in Before Sunrise, but it was romantic in the sense that I was running all over the place, meeting fascinating people, having fascinating conversations, and growing and learning a lot. So Britain, Britrail, the greatest.
That happened. I was 21, 20, turned 21 in England the very first time I went to on a trip like that by myself.
What sorts of places did you go when you were there?
Well, I had less of a free range sort of time. I was in college and I went to an 8-week drama camp at RADA, at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. I had to audition to get in. It wasn't just the 4-week course. But then the free time was just spent eating and sightseeing and going to all of these little places and getting lost. I had this dog-eared copy of A to Z that I've kept because it's taken on kind of a talisman sort of.
And so listeners know the A to Z is a street guide to London.
Street guide to London that you could fit in your pocket.
Okay. Getting lost is a very important part.
Yep.
Because that's the problem. I think with the cell phone not allowing us to get lost, getting lost is the greatest. You know, yeah. I wanted to see a band that I had become obsessed with, Susie and the Banshees.
Oh, yeah.
So I bought a ticket while still in America. I made a long distance call and they were very expensive back then, you know, to make a long distance call. But I went by myself to see this punk, you know, what was then very much a punk band. And I fought my way to the front. I was from Southern California, right? So I was a all American girl. I did not have my hair dyed purple or green or anything. I was wearing jeans and a t-shirt. I was the only kid in there who wasn't all decked out with, you know, like incredible piercings and mohawks and green, and they were scared of me. When I walked in, everybody stared at me and some people came up to me with their huge mohawks and they said, you know, hi or hello or whatever. And I said, hi. And they all jumped. They were frightened of me. And I had so many crazy adventures. I don't know what everybody could just peg me immediately as a non-Brit, you know.
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't ask, did you meet a guy, Kim? Did you meet a guy on a train?
The guy I met who really sticks out in my mind, I met at a Bob Dylan concert in London.
Wow.
It was at Wembley. And, you know, I went by myself and I had a ticket and I sat next to a very cute guy. And he and I ended up blabbering through the concert. Of course, Bob Dylan was just a tiny little speck way, way down below. And we ended up blabbering and he was so funny and so cute. And I liked him and he liked me. I was, I think, leaving very shortly after that. I guess I gave him my address. He wrote me a letter. And then somebody who, someone, probably a guy, must have found the letter and threw it away. So I was able to write this guy back.
Oh, no.
Oh, so it's kind of a sad, you know, kind of got a sad ending. And the guy probably didn't know why I never wrote him back. It's someone threw it away and found it.
Oh, my gosh.
During that time, and I think the technological moment of the 80s and 90s is something that we're going to come back to in this conversation because, you know, we're both on either end of Generation X, and it feels like travel then was just a different kind of monster than travel is now.
The feeling of we have to connect now. You know, we don't have the ability to check up on each other with WhatsApp multiple thousands of times a week.
It's an urgency. You know,
I mean, that line in the film, I watched it last night for the 80th time. And the line where he's like, look, if someone gave me the option to either marry you or never see you again, I mean, then I would choose marrying you. There was that urgency of we might never see each other again. And I don't think that these young whippersnappers understand how that felt. Of everything being now.
No, and they research each other. They Google try to figure out, they try to, you know, get the history on people and figure out if they're a serial killer or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, right. I mean, and they follow each other and they Yeah, they look through their feed on Instagram and see what they're all about and all that. But back then, there was definitely a risk factor, but also you're relying on your wits.
Yes.
Right? And yeah. There's a romance to that.
Yes.
There's a vulnerability to that, too.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I was... The trail of me reaching out to you, Kim, was I read a New York Times story about 5 years ago that spoke with you. And I think it spoke with Rick Linklater talking to his daughter about just sort of how that emotional vulnerability doesn't happen anymore. You know, we're sort of in this state of continuous partial attention. And so it's interesting how I think there's something very true and universal about the Before Sunrise story, but it's also very trapped in a moment that's sort of not replicable now.
Yes, yes. And you know, I think a lot about this, about how the world is changing with the advent of the internet. And I mean, I got to think there's some things that are good about it, but gosh, we are, it's like we're in a tidal wave.
Yeah.
And we're trying to get our bearings and we're upside down and we're spinning and we just don't know how to navigate this. We're trying to do it as gracefully as possible, but we scroll our phones and we're just jamming information into our brains. But all that, like, for example, all the time that we spent on the trains, say on the Brit Rail train, all that time just staring out the window, I don't think that that was in any way boring or lost time. It was time spent imagining and dreaming and constructing. And Picasso said that when he was sitting in the park staring out at seemingly nothing, he was actually working very hard. Yeah. And so I think now that we don't have enough time just staring off into space, you know, I think that's partially why when we're driving or we're standing in the shower, we have our best ideas.
Mm-hmm. 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 I couldn't agree more. I mean, you're speaking to the choir. I am not as Luddite as I hope I am one day, but I'm not on any social media due to mental health reasons. And I think that watching the film last night just reiterated to me, and Rolf said this earlier, like, we can't get back to that time. And I think we're collectively making a choice not to. I mean, seeing Before Sunrise last night, again, for the whatever time, it's aspirational, I've realized, as much as anything. Like, I want to have those connected moments again with people where you have these desultory walks where you suddenly come across something that sparks your imagination, or you meet some crazy German guys or Austrian guys who are having a theater performance that you don't go to because you go to this other thing, like, as opposed to everything being so calculated by our phones. I just was so charmed and inspired by the film for a different reason than I was when I was younger. Yeah.
You know what that reminds me of when you say that? The calculation, to me, calculation is a very left brain thing, right? Mm-hmm. And you're talking about, say, wandering through a neighborhood and you end up veering off in a direction you weren't expecting. That's right brain, I think. That mm-hmm. kind of wandering and exploring and not having a plan, to me, is so very right brain. And that's what, I mean, with my travels, I would always, and I always tell my screenwriting students this. I think of it as this. Do you know, some of us are more structured than others. They always ask how structured I am. I say, hey, you can approach art however you want. There's no hard, fast rule. But I like to think of things as I build a trellis, and the trellis is a loose structure. And then I plant the plant, which is a magical thing, and I don't know how it works because it's magical. How does photosynthesis work and how do all those magical things under the soil work? I don't know. But that's the right brain. And so when traveling, I like to have a loose structure, like, okay, I'm going to head toward this city. Then I'm going to go toward this city and then this city. But if something comes around, like I see a sign that says, you know, such and such a tour over here, or there's a, you know, check out the such and such restaurant, or look at that beautiful, you know, mountain. I'm free to twist another direction. And it's the same with creativity. I have my trellis. I know in general, this is in general what we're doing, going from here to here to here. But within that, I'm going to try to let my right brain do its thing and have its moments of magic, because I don't want to take that away. You know, that's the part that really ends up being great. So the trellis just holds it up, or the map holds it up. But the exploring is what makes it great.
It's a great metaphor.
Yeah, I watched Before Sunrise before I had a passport, and so it's sort of modeled. Now I'm a travel writer, but it sort of modeled a kind of travel. And I tell you what, I was so nervous for Jesse, because if it would have been me, I would have been inexperienced traveler. I would have planned activities. I would have gone to the play with the cow. I would have been so nervous, at this ravishing French woman, that I would have probably micromanaged it to the point where all of the romance would have been sucked out. And so it's interesting how maybe it's even harder now to leave ourselves open to chance, just to wander in and let the city be the map, let the connection be the map to how we move through a place.
Absolutely. I do feel like the internet is giving us too many quote unquote answers. Like, we look up a restaurant before we check it out to see what the other people's reviews are.
Yes.
A book to see what other people's reviews are. And I've come up with, like, I've made a rule for myself. I don't read reviews of movies, because I just want to feel it myself and not graft on somebody else's opinion, which is probably going to get me all confused about what my natural reactions are. And I generally don't look at now reviews of books and things. I may glance at the little description, but I've decided, look, people's opinions, sometimes they're just wrong,
Yeah.
Nobody bought Van Gogh paintings, and now his paintings are selling for many, many millions, in auctions. So people's opinions, that's just someone's opinion. So I kind of say to myself, just, like, does this restaurant look interesting? Let's just check it out. If it's great, it's a discovery. We made the discovery. If not, we won't go back. How about that? So
it's allowing yourself to make mistakes too, I think,
which are a very important part of learning. Because when I think of that first trip that I made by myself to England, I learned a lot through mistakes. I learned a lot by, say, going to something that I didn't enjoy and having to find a way out of there, or, meeting someone who was a little scary and having to get out of that situation. I learned that I can rely a lot on my wits.
Yeah.
We're not stupid. We have instincts.
Exactly.
We have the ability. We have so many, like, imagine these were formed over, over eons of evolution, like, so that we could read situations and people, and we could cut on out of there if it ends up being a bad experience. We don't need to look up the review necessarily. It's sometimes the worst experience ends up being like the greatest story.
Yep.
Right?
Well, as a travel writer, I can say yes. I actually tell my students, it's a wonderful vacation is harder to write about than a misadventure, right? And so I'm curious, Sunu, we've talked a lot about travel itself. At a certain point, Rick Linklater decided he was going to entrust you to a story. And so I know how travel informs my travel writing. How did your travels inform the screenplay that eventually became Before Sunrise? What's the genesis of that screenplay?
So it was not a travel movie. When he first talked to me about it, so I had been in his movie Slacker, and I had been in his movie Dazed and Confused. By the way, I was not a trained actor. I was doing this for fun. And so it's just kind of a miracle that I was, cast to be it and do this for fun. And he, The very first thing I told him about myself when I auditioned for Slacker was that I was writing a master's thesis on the diarist Anna Eastman. And he asked me a bunch of questions on that. I was in the midst of writing it. And at some point, he asked me if I'd finished it. And he asked if he could read it. And wow. So, yeah. And so I ended up giving it to him. And he, right away, it was like the very next day after I'd given it to him, he asked if we could meet the following day. We met the following day in a restaurant in Austin, Texas, and he had it with him. And he said, well, I read it. I really enjoyed it. Would you write a movie with me? And
that's incredible.
It's like, what are you talking about? I've never written a movie. You know, I don't know. And he said, it doesn't matter. You know, Rick was an untrained, you know, he did not go to film school. He was very much self-taught, you know, seen every movie in the world probably, but he was very much self-taught. And I think he really believed in that method. And he said, it doesn't matter. And I said, well, what kind of movie? What are you talking about? He said, some sort of boy-girl movie. And he said, let me finish all the post-production on Dazed and Confused. And then we'll get together. And so I was really hoping it would pan out. It did. So he told me, okay, I'm done. I'm done with Dazed and Confused. Let's get together. And that very first night that we got together, we were both like, we had our notebooks and we were talking about possibilities. And I said, you know, I've traveled alone and it's a really interesting thing to meet people when you're traveling alone. Sometimes you meet a cute person on the train or when you're sightseeing, and somehow you start talking, and the next thing you know, you're spending the whole day sightseeing together or going to an amazing place like Stonehenge, or you're at a concert. And he said, and I said, and another thing is that I've noticed your films have very finite beginnings and endings. Like Slacker takes place in about a 24-hour period. Mm. If you use the same thing, when you meet somebody, very often there's this finite beginning and ending. You meet them maybe on the train. Then maybe you get off the train, walk around a city together. Then somebody has to get back on the train, because their plane is leaving or something. And so he said, great, that's our meeting point. You know, that's how it'll work then. So he immediately loved that idea, that way to structure a story. Hmm.
And then where did you go from there? Did you just sort of talk about your own travel experiences? And I mean, the story itself is very specific, but you're an England traveler, not a Vienna traveler. I'd imagine Rick similarly had his own very specific experiences. So where did it go from there?
Well, so I, at that point, had also traveled in Europe by myself. I had done the same sort of thing with a Eurail pass. I traveled all over the place. Having, you know, many great experiences and also making mistakes where I would go somewhere and then not like it and get out of there. So it was the same sort of deal. It was like I'd have my general plan and I met a ton of people. And so I don't know that he had done that much traveling at that point. So we at first did not know that the movie was necessarily going to be that much of a travel movie, because Rick thought it would be filmed in Texas, because his two films at that point had been filmed in Texas. He thought maybe this film would be made in San Antonio, which is not the most romantic place in the world, but we thought, oh, it might be, you know, maybe they would walk along the Riverwalk, because they do have a sweet little Riverwalk in San Antonio. But what happened was that Ethan Hawke became interested in the movie when Dazed and Confused did well. And Rick was showing the movie to different European, in Europe, they have governments who, they want to promote their countries via the making of movies in these places, because obviously you can make a great period piece in so many of the wonderful cities in Europe. And so there were, I think, a number of cities and countries that expressed interest, but the one that ended up panning out was Vienna. Mm. And so Rick then said, well, we need to find a European actress to play the role. And so Julie got the part. We then were able to fit the various parts of the script into locations in Vienna, but it was not as mapped out as it would seem, because the conversations could fit in any number of
places. Yeah.
And did you, I mean, it's a very philosophical movie, and it actually, we as older people who watched the movie 30 years ago, we realize how much they talk about old love and old partnerships and stuff. And so was there a map, like a philosophical or a thematic map that you got, the points that you wanted to insert into the movie?
Yes, definitely. Because I think Rick and I love that sort of conversation. He and I had already established at that point that we enjoyed talking. Every time I saw him, he would say, hey, what are you reading? What are you thinking about? What's going on with you these days? And it was the same with him. You know, he would be thinking about certain issues or philosophies or politics or whatever. And so we were both great conversationalists, I think, is what it was. You know, I would say, oh, I'm reading about such and such, or I'm, you know, noticed this in the news, and I thought this was an interesting or funny event. And so we had a very easy time writing out these conversations, because when we wrote the script together, when we got past that point of mapping it out and creating the trellis, so to speak, had pinned up scenes on a poster. Then we moved over. We did that all at my house. Then when, and that happened very, very quickly. Then when we moved over to his house, because he had a computer, you see, and I did not have a computer yet, because this was in 1993, and I did not have a computer yet. He did. And so we were at his house. He pinned the poster over with that had all the scenes over his computer. And then he would sit down and type out lines, and then I would sit down and type out lines. And so while someone was, let's say while he was typing out lines, I would be pacing around in his living room or looking at his bookshelf and looking at the books. And we would work for long hours, just back and forth, talking, writing, talking, one of us getting an idea, sitting down, writing. Then at some point during the evening, going for a walk down to the convenience store, you know, getting a snack, then coming back, writing some more. So it was very, very relaxed and it was fun. And it was like a journey, as you guys know, like doing a creative project is a journey in and of itself that, you know, you go through a lot emotionally as you like are playing a part or you're teaching a class even. You're going through a huge journey emotionally with various characters and or real people or fictional. You're going through the journey. And so we were going through a gigantic journey writing together. And it was all very, you know, it was intellectual, it was emotional. But then later, when there was the matter of Vienna in and of itself, when I got to Vienna, I remember Rick was excited because he could show me the various locations, and we went to a beer garden and we talked a lot, and we went to an ice cream place and we talked a lot. So it was all, you know, it was the whole thing was a huge adventure.
It sounds magical. Well, yeah. Really, I mean, like you said, the process itself sounds equal to the product or the piece of art, rather.
And I'm curious, calling it a journey is interesting for me because we remember our journeys in fond and tender ways. And so you have the journey that was the creative process. Then you have the movie itself, which people must reflect back to you all the time because people react so personally to the movie. So I guess I might ask, what were your expectations once the movie was done? And then what role does it play in your life now, 30 years on?
Excellent question. I had no idea what was going to happen with that because, you know, this was the first script I'd ever written. I did not know how this would pan out. I knew that there's a certain cynicism in a slacker. There's a certain, comedy, I guess, in Dazed and Confused. I had no idea what would happen in Before Sunrise. And so I remember Rick assembled the main players, meaning the cinematographer, me, the producer, together one morning to go see the movie in a theater in Austin. This was before it was coming out. And so we were the only people there. We sat there and watched it, and I remember thinking, wow, the tone is, it's got the wistful romance that I really like. I was later told by people, it's so you, they said, which is huge. People said to me, it's very you. It's very much like talking with you. And so that was a huge thing for me to find that I'd come through. It's to have people talk to me about it is a really strange experience because I almost felt that after it was done for me and I'd seen the movie, that a part of me sealed off emotionally. It's like, I think this is the case with doing any creative project. While you're in the midst of it, you're wide open and very vulnerable and very sensitive. But when you're done with it, you seal back off because you can't walk through the world with that sensitivity because it's too vulnerable. You could be injured, you know. So I sealed off when I saw people's reactions, good and bad, I felt at peace because I felt like, well, I know how I feel about this story. And I feel like it said what I wanted to say. If people like it, great. If they don't like it, that's fine. You know, if they like it, they're probably my people. Mm-hmm. If they don't like it, we probably wouldn't connect in the real world. That's fine. That's fine with me because we don't connect with everybody. Yeah. And so I sealed off. And when I hear people talk about it, it's almost like they're talking about something else. Huh. You know? Do you know what I mean?
I don't. I feel like I'm so porous as a person. I think that is such a healthy way of existing with your work. And I think if you could bottle that up, there would be some takers. We just co-wrote a short film together that's making the film festival rounds or not, as the case may be right now. And I'm too close to it right now, I think, to really have any, not that we've had any criticisms of it, or at least not to our face, but I think that is an amazing way of being in the world with one's work. I applaud you for that.
Well, you know what? I think that sealing off is going to come for you. I think that you're going to feel really vulnerable while the various film festivals are looking at it. And I don't blame you at all. But I think somehow after this whole thing wraps up in some future year, you're going to seal off and move on to another thing.
Yeah.
I believe it's coming. So it's healthy for you probably to do that later down the line, but I understand how you feel right now because, you know, creative people are vulnerable, you know, and sensitive. They really, really are. I know. And I think it gets easier with time, though. I really do. I think it gets easier with time.
That's good to hear.
It's like showing your soul to somebody at first.
I know.
Yeah. 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 Absolutely.
it feels like film is a collaborative medium too, because I'm a writer, and when I have a book come out, my name is on it, and I had an editor who played a quiet role in it. Whereas writing a screenplay, you know, people talk about that movie for days and weeks, and they talk about Rick and Julia and Ethan Hawke. And so there might be a sense of which, I mean, what is it like to have created a collaborative work? I mean, does it feel like a certain sense that people have read themselves into it, that they watch the movie and it doesn't feel like it's yours anymore?
People do tell me a lot that they saw themselves in the characters. People say, hey, I met somebody while on a trip. I married the person, or I will never forget the person. People do come to me with these stories quite a bit. And so, you know, they hold it in their hearts. They, you know, the movie is important to them, and they hold it in their hearts. And I know that feeling, because I have movies that I can barely talk about because I saw the movie, say, I don't know, when I was 13 years old and babysitting at somebody's house, and it spoke to me about my life and answered a bunch of questions. And I then understood why I felt such and such a thing. And I really can barely watch the movie without crying. And so I understand those feelings. And I feel like it's kind of a sacred area. Yeah. It's kind of sacred to people. Because that whole emotional area of somebody's psyche, of like, this is my story. I mean, I think this is why we tell stories, and we go to the movies, and we read books, and it's like we're looking for our story in some way, because we want to, I guess, to feel that we're not alone. We want to feel that we've got some guidance. We want to feel that we have companionship in a certain way, or maybe instruction or something. But when people come to me and say that, I always, you know, am grateful. I'm grateful that they feel touched. And I don't quite know how to thank them, except to say, just thank you. You know, thank you for telling me. It means a lot. You know.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are included in that pantheon.
Absolutely.
In that group of people who've been affected by it. I know that you don't have a lot of time today, so I want to ask you one more question, which is, what are you working on now? We've talked a lot about creativity over past years. What are you focusing on in your creative life right now?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that. I've actually just started looking through my old diaries, and I thought that I would look in there and see if anything in there. I had this policy for many years of not going back, but now I'm at an age where I do want some sort of, I want context. I want perspective. And I think I want to go back and look and see what I wrote and see if there's something there that is worthy of writing. And especially because I feel like we had a huge, huge cultural change with the advent of the internet. Yeah. And I feel like I lived at the end of an era. I was born at the end of an era. I lived through the end of it. I had the privilege of co-writing a movie that I think for a lot of people encapsulates the romance of it. Now I think I should go back and look and see if I can find that in my diaries and maybe write about it.
Can I relay my little anecdote?
Sure, yeah.
I'm going to throw Rolf a little tiny bit under the bus, but I think it speaks. I'm just now making this connection. One of my favorite plays on the planet, and I've had the benefit or the privilege of doing it twice, is Uncle Vanya. And we both think Chekhov is incredible, not only as a playwright, but as a short storyteller as well. But when I was doing it a couple years ago, or close to 10 years ago now, the director at the time, Bob Falls, said that, and he was a bit older, he was in his 60s, I think, when he directed it, he said it is as relevant at every age, because Chekhov has this ability to speak to all ages. And here I am last night in our bed watching Before Sunrise. And Rolf was like, well, we have to watch it. We're going to interview her tomorrow. And I said, I've seen it before. He's like, let's watch it again. So it's fresh on our minds. And we were tired, but I'm watching it and I'm watching it and I don't want to turn it off. And I'm watching it and watching it. And there Rolf is next to me asleep. And I'm watching this story of young love talking about being afraid of older love. And my husband's gently snoring. And I'm thinking, you know what? It's not so bad. I'm both able to live through these characters and touch my younger self, but I also love this person who's gently snoring next to me. And isn't it amazing that I'm able to, your script was able to touch me in different areas of my life. And I think that that is the mark of really good work, to be able to speak to people in different stages of their life. So thank you for that. As opposed to it being this wistful thing that I can't touch anymore, I was able to then go, you know, I'm still here and we are still here, even though it's 20 years older than these characters that you created.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned, including information about Kim Krizan and the screenwriting class she'll be teaching with me in Paris this August, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, who also does the theme music. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts. Literally, within 36 hours of interviewing Kim, we ran into a poet, Melissa Feit Johnson, who wrote a poem called Before Sunrise on the VCR, and she showed it to me. She was doing an event here in Kansas. And you have not read it yet, so I would love it if you could read this poem.
Melissa has eschewed the advice given to her by certain poetry teachers about how you shouldn't have much pop culture in her poetry, and she's like, I love pop culture. I'm not going to take that note. So this is Before Sunrise on the VCR by Melissa Feit Johnson. I'd never felt this before, pulse and breath. Oh, I wanted him. We'd steal a bottle of red from the bar, sleep in the park. I longed for the 90s, some wistful before, though it was the 90s. Ode to his leather jacket and goatee, ode to her jumper and baby tee. Before the first day of school, I laid out an approximation of her outfit on my bed. Whew. I wanted to be her before my father died, before my brother moved to Rhode Island, before my mother and I had weekly therapy, before my mother's new husband said, the best thing about me was my tits. Before boyfriends took what they wanted while I hovered outside my body, a basin brimming with others' needs. My husband asked before even holding my hand. Our first date, not in Vienna, but at our hometown mall deli. I don't give my words to street poets anymore. I'll write the poems. Wow.